The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Mark Cleveland. I'll be reading Masks by S.E. Lewis. Melinda's talking a mile a minute before she even walks through the front door about whatever latest news vid caught her excitement on the rail ride home, the same as she's done every weekday for the past 6 years that we've lived together. Her enthusiasm is just one of the many idiosyncrasies that draw me to her. Oh, Jason, it's the greatest thing. Just think, you could choose anything you wanted. They mold and craft them to your specifications. Before long, the tech will be cheap enough you could have a selection, one for every day of the week or month. Hey, you wouldn't have to keep that secret calendar anymore. One look at my face in the morning, and you know it was the day to lay low, she laughs, winking. I've been so caught up enjoying the expressions that cross her face, I have to catch up on the content. Wait, a selection of what? Why, faces, of course. Have you heard any of what I've been saying? I watch her familiar look of exasperated patience as I process a response and begin to sputter. But I love your face. It's yours. It's the one I love to wake up to every morning. The others would be mine too, silly. I'd own the exclusive rights after all. I could finally change that little bump on my nose on the days that it drives me crazy. Could be such fun. She heads to the kitchen, taking my capitulation for granted as she has always done. But why? All those faces would just be masks. She turns to me, her expression a portrait of wide-eyed surprise. Aren't they all?
I'm Emily Chiola, and I will be reading A Villain Turns Mad by James Beeman. I'm on the set of a big-budget movie, mere moments away from destroying Hollywood, not with one of my patented doomsday devices either. No, my plan involves wrecking the industry from the inside by turning public opinion against it and its bogus propaganda. No one needs to manually cock the hammer back on a modern gun. Bombs aren't built with differently colored wires, and you can't crash through real glass and not expect serious injury. I know about that last one from personal experience. Also from personal experience, medical insurance will not cover injuries sustained from jumping through a glass window, even if you claim you were escaping from a rogue murder bot. Speaking of which, the predictive analysis module, or PAM Fantastic, is sitting beside me on a metal folding chair where all us movie extras hang out waiting to be extra. We have reconciled since her initial boot-up murder attempt and have dedicated ourselves to ending the Hollywood propaganda machine. For reasons I'd rather not discuss, PAM is cleverly disguised as a Teddy Ruxpin doll. Teddy PAM looks up to me and gives the signature Ruxpin eye blinks I fell in love with as a kid. There's only a 33% chance of success, Mr. Fantastic, she says. Give me some of that Ruxpin optimism, PAM. Glass one third full, PAM cheers. We take in the movie set. It's a cutaway of a hallway. When the director calls action, iconic megastar Tom Cruise will run at full speed through the hallway and crash through the window on the far end, the start of a typical action sequence. The thing is, the window is actually sugar made to look like glass. The other thing is, it won't be in a second. I take out my diabolic ray, patent pending, and fire at the window. The invisible beam turns the sugar into glass. If you want to know the science behind it, check the patent. Roll camera, the director calls from his chair. Camera rolling, someone replies. Tom Cruise gets into position. The guy is small in an allergic to protein kind of way. Mark, the director calls. Someone steps in front of the camera with that box with the clapper thing on top and claps it together. Meanwhile, my own camera is running in the form of PAM's recording function. I'm fixing to watch Tom Bruise catch a serious injury, sell the video to TMZ for some much-needed cash, go viral, and then step in to push for reforms in the Hollywood storytelling method. A hero of my own making. Action, the director says. You're not getting away that easy, Tom Bruise says to literally no one. He runs full speed at the window, jumps. He bounces off the glass. Cut, the director yells. This is bullshit, I roar, standing up out of my metal chair. Tom Bruise whimpers some. The director looks over to me. Who the hell is this extra? One of the crew, a grip, a gaffer, who the hell knows, looks at me and I see recognition dawn on his face. Hey, that's Dastard Fantastic, he says, pointing. The other extras scurry away from me as if my name was Typhoid Mary, another person who undoubtedly hated her parents and went exclusively by her middle name. I adjust my glasses. My fake mustache feels in place.
You're mistaken, sir, I say in a deep voice.
You are too, the director says. You've been on TV more times than all my movie promos put together. You're trying to fool us with glasses and a mustache. At this point, I realize I've fed into more subtle Hollywood programming by believing this disguise wasn't crap. I'm ready to lie some more because, help, no one denies the truth better than me when all of a sudden the skylight above explodes in a shower of glass. Like a comet streaking to Earth, my old nemesis Miss Radiant lands in front of me amidst the shattered glass, kneeling in a pose I'm sure she lifted from a comic book. Her magnificent red and blue outfit and white mask elicits gasps from the crowd. I hate her so much. Miss Radiant, Teddy PAM squeals. I've heard terrible things about you. Yay meeting you! Miss Radiant ignores my quasi-traitorous murder bot. Your name reached my super ears, she said. I'm here to stop you, dastard. I scoff. From what? Being an extra? I'm fine, Tom Bruise calls from the background. No one cares. I'm sure you have an outstanding warrant or 24, she says with a smirk. Just civil court cases. Unlike you, the world holds me responsible when I break things. I look up at the shattered skylight. Ho ho, Miss Radiant begins. Stop, Tom Bruise shouts. Now all heads turn. I guess having heard this voice in some of your most cherished movies makes for an authoritative sound. Tom looks around the room as if he sees her surrounding by a legion of Brutuses. Maybe the plural's Brutai. Either way, he looks like we're stabbing him. You think you can come to my movie and instantly outshine me with viral video? That's when I notice everyone has their phones out, aimed at me and Miss Radiant. Viral this, Tom Bruise says. I quit! He storms off, and once again, no one cares. Miss Radiant and I glare at each other for unending moments, as is our tradition. Eventually, the director comes over. The studio just called, he says. Dastard, they want you to be the new star in this movie. They feel you'll bring that dark edge this picture needs, and I agree. Sign with us. Nah. $20 million, the director says. Wait, what? Those were some serious chips. Most folks don't know this, but it's not easy funding villainy. My only real revenue stream is patent trolling. These days I was cash poor. A payday like this could seriously get me back in the game. $20 million plus 1% royalty on gross. Sign right now in front of the best viral movie promo ever and we immediately pick up filming where we left off. How about it? Pick up filming where they left off. With me jumping through a window that's irrevocably changed to glass for revenue I desperately needed. Hollywood. It's enough to turn a villain mad.
I'm Joe Pinella. I'll be reading The Plowshare by John Michael Hansen. Oh, gather, youth of my master, and hear my tale. That's how these stories always start, as I recall from the bards. Yes, many a bard sang songs of me, for I was once the mightiest blade in the land. No, 'tis true. I look like a humble farming implement now, but I was forged into existence as the silver singing sword wrought by elfish magic for Sir Simeleon, Knight of the Realm, and many... What? Yes, I can sing. What's that supposed to mean? No, you wouldn't like my songs. Not suitable for children. Elfish, mostly. Designed to unnerve Sir Simeleon's opponents in battle. Lot of minor keys. No, I don't know the ballad of Lord Uthwig. I'm telling a tale, not taking requests. As I said, I was once the silver singing sword. Sir Simeleon wielded me in battle after battle to unite the kingdom for good King Aldo the First. No, I guess he wasn't all that good after all, but that was what we called him, and he was pretty good for a king. Yes, I'm aware of how many were slain during the unification. Slew a lot of them myself. I'm sorry, that was inappropriate, but true. At any rate, as history says, Sir Simeleon was thrown down in the final battle, and his squire took me up. Edgerton, his name was. Good lad. Always generous with the polish. Utter rubbish wielding me, however. I did my best, but I couldn't do anything when an arrow sprouted from his eye. After that, your great-grandfather Hugh picked me up. He was Sir Simeleon's page. Far too young to fight at the time, but even younger than you are. Quite a bit smarter than Edgerton, however. Decided he didn't want to be a knight after all, after seeing what had happened, and carried me off. Took up farming instead, and hung me on the wall to honor his master and me. But let's be honest, hanging on the wall, even being admired by everyone who saw me? Boring, so boring. You cannot imagine, or perhaps you can. Finally, one day, I whispered to your grandmother, pleading to be of some use. She was surprised to hear me speak, but she was smart, and she knew her father's tales. So we made a plan. I sang a song I had never sung before, calling out to the elf who forged me, the Nameless Smith. Yes, that was what they called him. Yes, I suppose then Nameless Smith actually was his name, not that I ever point that out to him. At any rate, he arrived that night, stepping through a doorway of oak and shadow, and took me away to grant my wish. Under an approving moon, he labored over me until I had been beaten into a plowshare. Now with your father and his team of oxen, I plow the fields and turn the earth, the hard, dirty work needed for the wheat to come. I do miss singing, though. So how does the ballad of Lord Uthwig go?
Elena Clevenger here. Next up, Ready Made by Shannon Fay. Though there was a bowl of hammer pills in the living room, hammer pills for a quicker-than-liquor buzz. Cora elbowed her way through the crowd and went into the kitchen to pour herself a glass of wine. Getting drunk the old-fashioned way always calmed her down. It gave her that warm, fuzzy feeling of being a child again and stealing fingers from her dad's bourbon bottle. The party seemed to be a success. People were laughing, talking, dancing. Some of the more attractive/confident guests were playing spin the bottle in the corner. What were they, 12? Not that Cora was any expert on what people did at parties. Her mom would be so proud of her playing hostess, drinking socially rather than alone on the couch. "Oh, Cora," her mother had sighed after catching teenaged Cora sneaking into the liquor cabinet once again. "Drinking alone is just too sad. Drink with friends and no one will say boo." The problem was Cora didn't have any friends. A girl bumped into Cora's elbow. The wine in Cora's hand came up and arced over the glass and onto her polka dot dress. "Oh, my God, I'm so sorry," the girl said. She smiled sheepishly. Great party? Cora said nothing, just breathed in and out deeply. She squeezed her way through the crowded hallway to reach her bedroom. Even through the shut door, she could still hear the music from the living room. Today's biggest indie hits. She didn't know the band or the song. The music pod had come with the ready-made party pack, along with the vacuum-sealed fruit and veggie trays. The box had assured her that it came with everything one needed to host a wild party. She loved ready-made. They just cut all the bullshit out of life. You didn't need to take the time to get to know the trends or people or even what you liked. Ready-made had it all ready for you. She changed into a different dress and ventured back out into the party. An especially frantic song pulsated out on the music pod. Was it louder than before? Its beats hit Cora again and again in the cortex. She came into the living room just as one of the dancing party guests tripped on his own feet and fell onto her coffee table. A corner leg buckled and both guest and table hit the ground. "Hey, my table!" Cora yelled. "Sorry," the guy muttered blearily as a girl helped him up. Her apartment wasn't usually this warm, or this loud, or this bad smelling. She sniffed and, following her nose, discovered that someone had thrown up in the pot of her bamboo plant. Cora took a deep breath. She needed another drink. The kitchen was packed with people talking and laughing with furtive giggles. Cora saw that her cupboards were open and everyone had glasses in hand. She then saw the empty wine bottle on the counter. "You drank my wine?" she said, disbelief blanching her words of color. Most of the guests looked at the floor or the ceiling, but one of them, the clumsy girl from before, shrugged. "So, if you're going to have a party, that's the risk you take." Cora's hands clenched and shook. This wasn't worth it anymore. "No, no, no. Everyone out." They all stared at her. She realized she had said the wrong words. She thought back to the ready-made instructions. "I mean, party's over." The music cut out. Her guests stared at her. They kept staring at her as they deflated, skin shriveling as the little motors inside them whined and sucked their extremities inward. 30 seconds later, Cora's kitchen floor was covered with half a dozen fleshy cubes and puddles of spilled wine. It was a similar sight in her living room. Cora was careful to step around the cubed partygoers. She'd pack them up in the morning and put them back in the ready-made party pack. For now, she was too tired to clean up. She sat on the couch and popped a hammered pill while enjoying the silence. "Sorry, Mom," she thought. "Social drinking is just too much of a hassle."
Kurt Benrood here. I'm reading The Other 42 by Sean Williams. After 1,000 years frozen between thoughts, Hart awakes to another dead system. It wasn't always dead. The planets have been extensively mined and parked in an orbital configuration that might last 1 billion years. The sun is surrounded by lenses casting complex beams and sheets of light out into the void. These refractions were what drew Hart here. There is biological life in abundance and evidence of advanced warfare. The civilization that once ruled here, however, is long gone. Instead of feeling despair, Hart begins the long process of cataloging her find. She is an expert archaeologist as well as a capable explorer. These two skill sets are a rare combination. A seeker of knowledge on the edge of the known universe, the data she carries will be of great interest when she returns home. On an icy moon among the system's outer planets, she finds something odd, an impossible configuration of matter in which electrons appear to be frozen. It looks like a monument of some kind, but under closer examination, she discovers that those electrons are indeed moving, only very, very slowly. The configuration is a sphere, 50,000 kilometers across, sustained by means unknown. Clearly a machine, but for what purpose, Hart can only guess. It is the 42nd such machine she has found in her long travels. They are not all like this one. Complex coils of superconducting cables winding around each other in a knot so dense it risks collapsing into another kind of matter entirely. One is a network of black holes orbiting in a deliberate dance that has lasted 5 billion years and shows no signs of ending. A second is a series of continent-sized curved plates slipping and sliding over each other in a clearly artificial process over which an entire biosphere has slowly accrued. A third is a complex fold in space, invisible until entered, that contains subtle shifts in the universe's fundamental constants, shifts that come and go in ways that bear no relation to what lays outside. 42 such devices are known to Hart. Taken as a set, they are superficially very different, yet they share two critical qualities. One, they are very old. Two, they are still operating. Hart studies them while at the same time taking care not to disturb them, or to get too close. She hasn't survived this long by recklessly assuming that the third characteristic they appear to share, that of ignoring her completely, will hold every time. Still, she does her best to provoke a response by signaling her origin, her species, her name, and her purpose. Not once did any of the previous 41 respond, and this new one is no different. They just keep on churning or spinning or exploiting whatever particular kink of physics it is they depend on for their existence, waiting out eternity in slow, patient activity. They haunt her, these remnants, these living mausoleums. What are they for? The building of them took great effort. Great returns must have been expected. Sometimes she imagines that there are living beings inside, the apotheoses of their civilizations, perhaps the ultimate embodiment of their creators themselves. If so, these machines might contain the greatest minds in the universe, wending away eons in contemplation. Of what? What are they thinking about? What can possibly require such an enormous expenditure of cognition? Hart doesn't know. All she can do is continue her work in anticipation of the archaeologist's reward, to return home and properly examine her discoveries. Her life's labor won't be complete until she fully understands what she has found. She is looking forward to getting started. Cracking the secrets of the ancients, Hart suspects, is going to take a great deal of thought.
I'm Joe Campo, and I'm reading In My Wheelchair, I Am Invisible by Sean R. McKee. In my wheelchair, I am invisible. It's my superpower. I glide silently down the street in the darkness, my wheels whispering on the asphalt. A pedestrian moves out of my way without making eye contact or even acknowledging my presence. Invisibility is a mixed bag as superpowers go, because I can't turn it off. Carefully, I cross the street. Cars are always a concern. From an early age, children are taught not to stare at people in wheelchairs, and over time, the constant reminders flip a switch in their brains. The alleys and sidewalks are dark. Above, the moon is obscured by quick-moving clouds. Most people are so afraid to offend that they remove us from their perceptions entirely. It's human nature, I guess. I hear a muffled scream from my right down one of the alleys. There are no police in sight. I see an emaciated body crouched over a prone form. Luckily for me, most monsters used to be human too. I start down the alley. The monster's glowing green eyes pass over me, oblivious as I raise the crossbow to my shoulder and take aim.
Emily Keola, and I will be reading The Cool Kids by Ellie Bangs. For a solid year, I was riding high, getting my fix, partying all night and sleeping all day, just like Phineas, cool and white as snow, who had mortals of all genders falling over themselves to be tasted, who had been 20-something for centuries. I thought we'd surf that ruby red high forever, me and him and the other cool kids, and I'd never have to suffer my own reflection again. But I woke up one night with an awful taste in my mouth, and when I brushed my teeth, there I was again in the silvered glass above the sink, hazy, translucent, but undeniably there. I almost screamed. "When's the last time you drank, Jason?" Phineas muttered, stretching awake. "If I don't get blood, I turn human again?" I sounded like a noob, but I was panicking. I could feel my skin rising above room temperature like a fever. "Relax. Plenty of blood on the dance floor." We went hunting in the club, but my confidence was shot. My moves didn't work with gravity pulling so hard. I was sick with my own heat, less cool by the minute. I was perspiring. I'd forgotten how bad a warm body could smell. I kept tonguing my receding canines. No mortal would offer me a neck. Phineas shouted in my ear, "Drink up already! You're bringing me down! My animal magnetism is gone! Then don't ask! Just take!" I tried. I found someone all but passed out drunk, but when her neck was right there, my appetite ripped out from under me. Without the seduction, without the hypnotically induced consent, something grotesque about the act of drinking was laid bare. I almost threw up. I ran off into the night, too sick and full of shame to look back or say goodbye. I ran into Phineas several years later in the early hours of some night. I invited him out for coffee. I thought we could catch up. We'd been close, once. "You're getting old, Jason," he said, rather viciously. I'd just turned 31. He was as 20-something as ever. "It's not all bad," I said. I calmly considered my reflection in the black mirror of the window, finally at peace with itself, and for just a second the thinnest trace of Phineas was reflected there with me, grimacing, turning away in self-disgust. He left without another word, and I stayed up to watch the sunrise.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.